This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
David Hales is done as Bloomington City Manager. Find out his thoughts going out the door.
Bloomington, like all cities in Illinois, are facing some tough financial times in the future. And that's definitely going to hinder maybe some of the bigger projects they'd like to achieve.
GLT student reporter Bailey Steelman interviews David Hales at a reception in his honor. Plus, turkeys stalk Bloomington Normal. Truth, not a low-budget horror movie. A story of immigrant detention, and the ACLU is chronicling quieter ways they say the Trump administration is eroding civil liberties.
That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. David Hales spent 9 years as Bloomington City Manager. He's gone now, off to a job in Joliet. And though Hales declined to an in-studio interview with GLT, student reporter Bailey Steelman caught up with Hales at his going-away reception at the BCPA. Steelman asked about Hales' successes and other issues.
You know, it's hard to really point to one. We as a team have accomplished many things. The financial strength of the city is light years from where it was when I came just before the recession. We've put the city on a good solid footing in planning for infrastructure improvements with all the master plans we've completed. We've right-sized the city's police and fire pensions, which will save $70 million. Over the next 80 years, we've got adopted an national award-winning comprehensive plan. So, you know, the list goes on, but it's not because of any one person's effort, but we've just had a great team, both from the council, our directors, employees, and the community. And that's what I feel good about, is there's just been that solid, strong community engagement to help achieve a lot of very positive things in the last 9 years.
What are some things that were possibly left undone?
There's always things, you know, you wish you could have done, but, sometimes resources are just not there. We do have in front of the council a draft 5-year capital improvement plan. They've made some significant advances in adopting some sanitary sewer and stormwater fees, but now it's time for the council to adopt that plan and then implement that. So we almost got to the finish line with that, but that's coming forward. But, if anything, Bloomington, like all cities in Illinois, are facing some tough financial times in the future, and that's definitely going to hinder maybe some of the bigger projects they'd like to achieve. But nevertheless, you know, the city's on a strong footing, and I'm just grateful to be a part of it.
Do you have any last-minute advice for the city council to stay on that strong footing?
Well, I shared a lot of that last Saturday with them, but if I think the one thing even they agree with is they need to make sure that the community is actively engaged in setting the priorities for the city. And right now it's infrastructure, and we've been working a lot on that. And so frankly, each year at budget time, throughout the year, it is so critical in this day and age because of greater needs than we have resources to make sure the community is engaged and gives input on priorities and goals, and then make sure that they support what can be some challenging decisions on their part. So I think that has to continue to be a critical element of good governance in the years ahead.
Do you think the council was unwilling to make tough decisions?
It just kind of depends upon the personality, some of the people. Sometimes decisions may have taken a little longer, but that's, sometimes that is good government, because you need to show some patience. You don't want to be swayed just by a few. Got to look out for the interests of the majority. If not a good consensus, and sometimes that just takes additional time. But there's no doubt, I think we could all sometimes be a little bit more assertive or move a little quicker. But it's a tough position, and I think that's why we see so few people want to run for public office, because it is not an easy job.
Are there any ways to improve relations with the town of Normal?
Oh, there's good relations with Town of Normal. Now I say that, our police, our fire, our public works and parks, there's a lot of good things. Yes, you know, there was a policy disagreement, you know, on a key important, but that hasn't stopped. Good collaboration, good cooperation, but, you know, we need to do more of that. And you'll see very soon in the BN Advantage funding, there's been a lot of private discussions on how can we be united as both Bloomington and Normal in supporting it, but maybe doing it in a little bit more frugal way. So I think the entire metro area will see continued greater collaboration between those two cities. It certainly has been there in the city manager's office.
How should the city deal with the deficit?
Well, that's a big question. You know, there's and time just doesn't permit to get into that. We did talk about that. In fact, one thing I urged Saturday is for the council, working with staff and the community, to come with a long-term strategy. You cannot address the continued financial chaos coming out of Springfield and the uncertainties of the future by dealing with the budget on just a year-to-year basis. They need to have a five-year plan so that each year, if nothing improves, you know, there's certainty as to what's going to happen and how do we take care of the employees. So but it's every city in Illinois and throughout the nation's facing the same dilemma.
Are there entrepreneurial ways to address issues when municipalities have to cut services?
Possibly. But when you say entrepreneurial, the private sector has really kind of given a lot of ideas of how to be sometimes more efficient and effective than the public sector. And that doesn't mean that we outsource a lot of services, but we've got to learn from the entrepreneurs, the private sector entrepreneurs, about how we can reduce costs but still deliver a quality product and service. So I think that's an ongoing continuous initiative people have to continue with.
How do you think the city should approach a downtown catalyst project?
I think, the first step is hearing from the committee and Amelia Burgess, the chairperson, and begin discussion on what those recommendations are. So I think that's planned, the first meeting in December, and then the hard work begins about how do you do that during these tough financial times, and what can we start out maybe a little bit smaller in scope, but still keep in mind some of these big projects.
I got one last fun question for you. What will you miss about Bloomington?
The people. Because we have thoroughly enjoyed living here the last 9 years. We've just come to embrace and appreciate the Midwest values. And this is a great family town, but it's a great town to live in as empty nesters and, for all ages. And I think, and it's such a safe community too. So, if anything, you know, we'll miss the people here. But we won't be that far away. We'll still be in Illinois, just 2 hours up the road.
GLT student reporter Bailey Steelman interviewed former Bloomington City Manager David Hales. The new interim manager as of today is Steve Rasmussen.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the ACLU of Illinois is holding a panel discussion this evening at the Normal Public Library. We'll have a preview with their communications director. The number of illegal immigrants taken from the McLean County Jail to federal immigration detention centers has more than doubled in the past 9 months, from 15 to 39. Immigration attorneys say that previously people arrested on minor charges would likely be released by immigration judges if they could show they had significant ties to the community and no serious criminal record. Now even those with minor charges are being sent straight to detention centers to await hearings on deportation. Franklin Sandoval of Bloomington is one of them. He was arrested in September for driving without a license. Police found that there was a removal order pending against him. Sandoval is married to an American citizen and was in the process of trying to regulate his immigration status when he was taken into custody. GLT's Judy Valente reports on how the Sandoval case reflects the complexities many undocumented immigrants face in the Trump era of stepped-up enforcement.
Franklin and Laura Sandoval met at a Latin dance in Bloomington. She is a registered nurse. He was working at the time in a local restaurant. Before their marriage 3 years ago, Franklin told Laura he was undocumented, and they began looking into legalizing his status.
He didn't know how the process went. We both didn't. So I start looking into trying to figure out how to get it done. It was pretty rough. I actually had to ask a lot of people how they did it.
Sandoval said he had come to the U.S. from Honduras to escape street violence in his town and to search for work.
He lived in poverty, so his family didn't have anything. He didn't even was able to go to school. So he came up here to be able to get away from the lifestyle that was down in Honduras, because it's pretty violent down there.
By the time he met his wife, Sandoval had been living in this country without documents for 10 years. But with his new wife, his life was otherwise like that of many other young couples. Sandoval helped with the rearing of his wife's 3 children from a previous marriage. And together, the couple started a small business, Sandoval's Extra Hands. It did mowing, gardening work, painting, and other odd jobs for mainly elderly customers. One of those customers, Dan Hall, who is disabled, credits Sandoval with helping him and his wife to continue to live independently in their home.
He was just a regular handyman. There was more and more stuff for him to do, and he would always come whenever we called.
But there was a sword hanging over Sandoval. In 2010, he was arrested in Chester, Illinois, on a misdemeanor battery charge. The police report said he brushed up inappropriately against a woman. His English was poor at the time, and he could not read or write Spanish either. Because he had no prior record, however, he was released on personal recognizance pending a court hearing. He attended his first 2 court hearings without representation, but missed a 3rd hearing. A judge then issued a removal order. Kevin Reka, who is now representing Sandoval, says Sandoval didn't even know an order for his deportation had been issued.
I don't know that Franklin had explored or known how to explore what options were available to him here in the United States. Franklin is profoundly illiterate. He's unable to read or write in Spanish or English. He has some basic skills that he's picked up essentially on his own and through the help of others, but he never had any formal education in Honduras before coming to the United States. He has essentially never received any schooling in his entire life.
Even after the removal order, Sandoval was able to remain under the radar of Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials. That is, until last September 16th. He was leaving Holy Trinity Church in Bloomington after attending a service for his stepdaughter's quinceañera, or 15th birthday celebration. Driving his wife's car, he was involved in a fender bender not far from the church. When police arrived on the scene, they found Sandoval had no driver's license or any other identification.
The police came. They were going to let us go on a violation, a citation, I believe is what it was called. And they said that since he didn't have an ID, they didn't know if he was who he said he was. So they wanted to take him downtown just to make sure.
Checking his record, police came across a warrant for his arrest for failing to show up at his previous immigration court hearing. They took him into custody.
So me, I'm just thinking like, what do I do now? Of course, I kept calling up to the jailhouse trying to figure out what they knew, if they had heard anything, and or Franklin, you know, if he had heard anything. So it was just a lot of trying to figure out the resources and what was our next step.
Sandoval spent the weekend in the county jail. He was then sent to a Chicago facility for another 3 days. Finally, he was transferred to a federal detention center in Dodge County, Wisconsin, north of Milwaukee.
The first couple of weeks was really rough because I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know, you know, who to talk to. I kept calling the lawyer 3 times a day and trying to, you know, okay, so what's going on? What are we doing? I need somebody there, you know. Who do I call? But we had to wait also because he wasn't in the computer system either, not knowing what was going to happen. It was just really rough. I think I cried for like the first 2 weeks.
Laura Sandoval and her 3 children have not seen her husband since he was transferred to the Wisconsin facility 6 weeks ago. The visiting hours are strictly limited.
They go by the last name, and there's 2 days a week you go see him, and it's for a half hour, and it's only between a certain time during those 2 days.
She says visiting is not possible with her work schedule and family duties. She has had to shut down the family business without her husband's help and now works regular double shifts as a nurse to pay the family's bills.
But my mom has been kind of helping a little bit, and I have my sister has been kind of stepping in and helping with me. But, you know, being by my, you know, without him here, it's I got to be the mom, the dad, the husband, the wife, the yard keeper.
Sandoval calls his wife, Colette, from the detention center 2 times a day. On one call, he said he dreads going back to Honduras.
I feel bad because my family is right here, my wife and kids. And firstly, I've got all the business here in America. I don't know really much people in my country, Honduras.
In Honduras, he says, he would fear for his life.
Too many criminals, gangsters, killers, all stuff like that. Mico Pacu, Honduras. You know, people think I have money. So it's killing me or trying to kill one of my families for money, you know.
Laura Sandoval says that in detention, her husband's mental state is deteriorating.
When he got there, they put him in a big room with a whole bunch of people with bunk beds. And then I think recently they just moved him more into like a cell block type of place. There's no privacy. There's a whole bunch of people in there. He told me he hasn't seen the sunlight since he's went there on that Wednesday. He doesn't like the food. The food is definitely not what he's used to because he's more used to eating the Spanish type of food and and things that I cook. And up there, he's just like boiled egg, ramen noodles.
Kevin Reka, Sandoval's attorney, has filed a motion in the Chicago Immigration Court to reopen his case in an effort to have the removal order against him rescinded. Sandoval's fate depends on the discretion of a judge. Reka says in the past, given Sandoval's family and community ties, a judge might have been willing to release him on a bond or place him under some sort of supervision where Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement could track him. But, Reka says, the Trump administration has stepped up enforcement.
It's very frustrating as an immigration attorney today to see the system changing in ways that are just shifts in policy. They aren't shifts in the law. There are things that are being done differently now than 9 or 10 months ago. Unfortunately, we're not seeing as much consideration given to people's lives and to the effect that detention and these things have on people's lives. The focus is very much on enforcement and trying to remove people, and it's not to the realities of their lives here and the harm that this does to their families and to U.S. citizens.
Dan Hall, Sandoval's customer, agrees.
I think it's horrible. I mean, I talk to Franklin about every night or every other night, and he's just going through hell where he's at. I see no reason for that.
Laura Sandoval has posted a petition on Facebook for people to express their support for her husband's case. More than 650 people have signed it. Attorney Reka says he's rarely seen such an outpouring of support for one of his clients.
It really says something about who he is that when the community heard about this, so many people wanted to know what they could do to help in any way.
Laura Sandoval says she waits and prays. She's taken out a loan to pay nearly $10,000 in legal fees she's accumulated fighting her husband's case. She says in the worst case, her husband will be deported, but she will continue trying to gain legal status for him as the spouse of an American citizen. That process could take years, something Sandoval says she prefers not to think about right now. I'm Judy Valente.
Local police and the McLean County Sheriff's Department say it's not their policy to seek out undocumented immigrants.
NPR One is a whole new way to listen.
I like that it mixes things for me automatically.
Catch up on NPR and GLT News. Customize the app for you.
It looks at the content that I'm looking at, I think. It feels like the thing is starting to anticipate things that I might like.
Share what you like. Skip what you don't. It's public radio made personal.
Hi, I'm Greg Kosorik from Bloomington, Illinois, and I listen to NPR One.
NPR One is at the Apple App Store and Google Play. Learn more at wglt.org/NPR1.
Support for GLT comes from Drake and Nancy at Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities. Member FINRA SIPC, offering 26 years of experienced, reputable, and timely financial management with a contemporary, independent perspective. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, GLTs grow. The Muslim ban, deporting bad hombres, ending DACA, these actions by the administration of President Trump are all getting major headlines. But the ACLU of Illinois says the Trump administration is affecting civil rights in quieter ways as well. Ed Yonke is the communication director for the ACLU of Illinois. He's in Bloomington Normal for a couple of appearances, including one at the Normal Public Library this evening at 7:15. Yonke says the erosion of rights is concerning to the ACLU.
One of the things that we're seeing is sort of reversals of long-term policies by the Justice Department or approaches by the Justice Department that really sort of quietly send a signal that populations and people who, you know, were getting protection and treatment by the Justice Department are going away. Three quick examples. The first is that the Department of Justice has completely reversed its policies in terms of overseeing, supervising, and seeking to reform state and local police agencies. So the Chicago Police Department in January, the Obama Justice Department issues a scathing 100-plus page report on practices within that Justice Department that would normally lead to a consent decree, federal court oversight, and reform of the department. And the Sessions Justice Department says simply, we don't want to do that. So the problems persist in terms of the police department, and there is no activity from the federal government in terms of doing that work.
At least in that case, though, is there the possibility that enough sunshine has been shown on that particular problem that some of those reforms can go forward? Has there been enough buy-in from the city of Chicago and the police administration to at least make a stab at reforming the culture?
No. The problems of the Chicago Police Department have been generations in the making, and they will have to be they are not the kinds of things going to be resolved by short-term political solutions. That's one of the reasons that actually in the light of the Department of Justice not playing its traditional role, we've actually sued the Chicago Police Department seeking a consent decree and federal court oversight to do exactly what it is that the DOJ should do. The problem is that it's much harder as an individual organization.
You got to prove standing.
You have to prove standing. You have to get the department and the city to agree to a consent decree. And then, of course, you have to have the staying power and the resources to oversee that decree over many years, which is a challenge in and of itself. I feel that the ACLU will still be there in 20 years to be able to do that. And so I think we're the right organization to do it, but it's a difficult task.
And it takes resources that could be better be spent or could be spent elsewhere.
It could be spent elsewhere. You could simply be monitoring what the Justice Department is doing as opposed to having to do it yourself. So it does. Here's another place where there's been quiet, changes in this administration that are problematic, although in both these cases, happily, not directly in Illinois. The first is that the department has reversed a policy that under the Obama Justice Department, where they were challenging the implementation of so-called voter ID laws. These laws have been found, frankly, to be discriminatory in their application and frankly, don't really root out any kind of voter fraud. The department has reversed position and says they actually favor the implementation of voter ID laws. And we've seen recently the department reverse the Obama administration's position and argue in federal court that an employer ought to be able to fire someone simply because they're gay or lesbian. And so what we're seeing is that whereas the Department of Justice had been a protector of many of these groups or in many of these places, that it's now actually being used as sort of a cudgel to defend those who would want to discriminate against them. And I think, you know, in all of the focus on each and every tweet, in all of the focus on, you know, the day in and day out, who's the latest spat with or what's the latest comment or, you know, who's in or who's out at the White House. I think those are the things which have really been lost.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with the Communications Director for the ACLU of Illinois, Ed Yonka. So what's to be done?
I think that, like everything else, the solution to this comes from within. It comes from within ourselves. I think it's really about people saying that, A, they want different policies, and, B, that they have an expectation for different norms. So it's about people really paying attention to these smaller issues that don't always get, you know, the wall-to-wall cable television coverage. It's about people asking elected officials what they think about these issues. You know, I've been saying to people, we've actually been traveling around the state over the last several weeks, and one of the things that I say to people all the time when they ask me what they should do is there should never be an event or a meeting or a radio show or a teletown hall meeting that a member of Congress has in which someone doesn't ask them, what are you doing to protect voting rights? What are you doing to protect immigrants and newcomers and asylum seekers? What are you doing to protect LGBT populations across Illinois and across the country? The fact of the matter is that most of this is being done in policy from the Justice Department or executive orders. And the fact of the matter is that we ought to be demanding that Congress look at these things, provide some oversight as to why they're being done in this way, and then reverse them even legislatively wherever appropriate. But I think it all begins with people sort of paying attention to these issues and continuing to talk about them.
Let's move to immigration. The number of immigrants arrested in Bloomington Normal for various offenses over the first 9 months of this year is lower.
Right.
Than last year.
Right.
The number of people taken from the McLean County Jail by Immigration and Customs Enforcement is higher than last year. So a significant percentage increase, although the overall numbers are relatively low.
Right.
What are you seeing in enforcement?
Yeah. So we're seeing, a couple of different things that are, I think, reflective of the broader kind of harsh immigration policies that we see from the administration. The first is in terms of enforcement. There is essentially been a kind of a not really a loosening of not loosening of priorities, but essentially an absolute elimination of any priority as to who's being targeted for enforcement. So over the last several years, in the past couple of administrations, there were people, some of whom had an order of deportation levied against them 20 years ago, but who have been fighting that, who are contributing members of the society, who, you know, live with their families, work every day. And during this time, they have been reporting regularly to immigration officials and, you know, saying where they are. They come back in. Their proceedings have been delayed as they've sought relief in other ways from the order of deportation.
And they were low-level offenses.
They were very low-level offenses, mostly just being present without documentation, not people who have committed crimes or anything of that nature. So what we're seeing across the country is when those people come and do their usual regular check-in that they have done, you know, every 6 months or every 9 months or every year for the last several years, they're now being taken into custody and put into deportation instantaneously.
Ed Yonka is the communication director for the ACLU of Illinois. He says ICE has grabbed so many people for deportation, they're now exploring private detention center options in northern Illinois and are also using the Kankakee County Jail to hold detainees. Yonka's talk tonight is at 7:15 at the Normal Public Library. The ACLU is also planning a town hall meeting at the Chateau November 29th. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A crowd-pleasing opening for a Democratic gubernatorial candidates forum held this week at the U of I in Urbana.
Thank you all for coming out tonight on the date that marks 1 year out from the day that we take this state back from Bruce Rauner.
Of the seven Democrats running, four of them were on hand to talk about why they should be their party's nominee to challenge Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. Illinois Public Media's Jim Meadows reports on how the candidates answered one question about the rising cost of attending college.
When moderator Tom Kasich of the News Gazette raised the issue of rising college tuition, several Democratic candidates sharing a table at the U of I campus forum said the answer was to make state college and university tuition free. That's what candidate Teo Hardeman called for. And to pay for that free tuition, Hardeman says he wants to move from a flat state income tax to a graduated one, and also to put a tax on financial transactions, like the sale of stocks and commodities. Hardeman estimates those two changes could bring in $5 billion a year in additional state revenue.
So under Hardeman and Avery administration of 4 years, that's $20 billion of new revenue here for the state of Illinois. So we plan to use some of those funds to make college tuition free for college students. And I'm not just saying this because I'm running for governor. This is what we believe in. Make college tuition free up into the bachelor's degree level.
Hardeman was alone among the candidates in supporting a tax on financial transactions, a proposal currently languishing in the Illinois House. But State Senator Daniel Biss said that, like Hardeman, he also supported free tuition at state universities and community colleges. The suburban Chicago lawmaker said free college is as sensible as free public schools.
We made a decision 100 years ago as a society that you need an elementary and secondary education to be competitive, and so we made free access to universal public elementary and secondary education. Our economy has changed. It's time for our public services to change with it, and it's time for free college.
Bob Diber, the lone downstate candidate, wouldn't go that far. He called for raising state funding for state colleges and universities, but only back to 2012 levels. Diber also said state universities need to be at the front of the line when lawmakers are working out the state budget because they're both an educational service and an economic engine.
And it's got to be a priority because higher ed is an economic stimulus for the state in every university town. Students bring revenue to the state as we attract them, and they also provide revenue when they're graduates.
But moderator Tom Kasich had a follow-up question. If higher education should be a top priority for state funding, do other state programs have to make do with less? Former University of Illinois Board President Chris Kennedy rejected the premise. Putting down his unreliable wireless microphone, Kennedy got up from the candidates' table and told the crowd that a graduated income tax would not only pay for free state college tuition, but could raise money to help all state programs.
You can't say to the state of Illinois, the people of Illinois, that you have a choice between affordable higher education and all other services. That's not true. What you have a choice between is a state with a great future that's funded by a progressive graduated income tax, or a state that stalls out.
The candidates also answered questions about promoting job growth, helping downstate communities, what to do about state pensions, and gun violence. The Illini Democrats, which put on the event, said it was the only gubernatorial candidates forum organized by students this campaign season. They estimated attendance at up to 200, with a few more following live on Facebook. I'm Jim Meadows.
In addition to the four candidates attending the Monday event, J.B. Pritzker, Robert Marshall, and Alex Baterikas are also seeking the Democratic nomination for governor. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Just because cool weather is here doesn't mean you're quite done with yard work. In fact, the investment you make now in your landscape will pay gorgeous dividends come spring. Patrick Murphy has more in this edition of GLT's Grow.
In the midst of autumn, it's a great time to prepare for spring. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Great to see you, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, we're talking about great bulbs to plant. We got to get those in the ground so we can have a gorgeous springtime.
That is for sure the truth. And, you know, the funny thing is you do your fall cleanup and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much have it done by now, except for chasing some leaves. But when it's all done, there's one more project left.
There we go.
And it's the Boku Bulb Project, right?
Right.
And tulip bulbs are just a fascinating thing to gardeners, landscapers, and hort geeks like myself. There was a time in our history that there was the tulip mania, that's 1634 to 1637.
Mm-hmm.
And we all heard about this. But there was, at one time, the value of tulip bulbs was equal to or greater than the value of coined money.
Why? Why so valuable?
It was just very novel. Mm-hmm. It was just very novel. And there was one particular bulb called the Semper Augustus. At the time, it would sell for 10,000 guilders. That's a Dutch monetary deal. And you could have bought yourself a home on a canal. That's
with
a
just one bulb?
One bulb.
What this thing looked like when it bloomed?
Well, it was pink, and some of the original prodigy of tulip bulbs, by the way, are one of the most domesticated crops that have ever existed. They share that with marijuana, potatoes, and apples.
What an interesting family.
Yeah, baby, coming over for marijuana, apples, and tulip bulbs. And so nowadays, they're just as popular, but they're much more affordable, thank goodness.
Yay.
Right? And before we get into the particulars of some of those favorites, I want to tell everybody a great way to plant tulip bulbs is to get the soil auger that goes on the end of your drill. You can drill all the holes, and they bring this crumbly, nice soil that goes right back into the little hole.
Wow.
And it can speed the process up, and it can also ensure you some extra success. Because the tulip bulb sits snugly in this hole, so it remains upright. So even when the water fills that loosely soil-filled hole, it's not going to make the tulip bulb float and turn over.
Is this like point end up? Do you want point end up?
You do. And okay. You can see there's a little cluster on the bottom of the tulip bulb that looks like
the roots,
a
huh?
hairy
yeah.
deal, like a hairy navel. That's roots down. Yeah. So I do have some favorite bulbs, Laura. You want to talk about some favorite bulbs?
I would love to talk about some of your favorite bulbs.
I love purple and blue things, and anyone that's been to my house knows that. I can prove it.
Okay.
My whole house is blue, but there's one large tulip that I find to be striking, and it's a large early tulip, so that means it's on a tall stem. You know, it can be 18 to 20, 24 inches tall.
Gracious.
It's the Purple Prince.
Okay.
And it is just a traditional shaped, C-shaped cup tulip bulb on a large pale green stem. and that purple stands up tall. So you could plant this amongst other ground cover plants or woody shrubs that might be ground cover so that the tulip bulb pokes up through the leaves or the needles of what's close to the ground.
Standing tall like a crown prince.
Indeed, indeed. Now, this is the next one is my very favorite of all times, and it's a tulip bulb of antiquity, and it is the Viking.
Oh, the Viking. Yeah, I can see that.
I love the Vikings.
What's it look like?
It's been popular for over 100 years or longer, and this was a tulip bulb that was around back during the tulip mania, but this is a scarlet tulip with yellowy-green wavy foliage, and it's short. It's close to the ground. And
it comes with a sword, right?
That's right. It comes with a sword and really bad breath from eating nothing but meat. And this is a neat tulip bulb because if you're a tulip lover, you know that to have the tulips year after year, you have to leave them grow for a while
after the leaves flower
show is over.
Right.
And the Viking is great for that because the foliage is attractive, little noodly, wormy kind of leaves.
Terrific. You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening shows for those who like to get their hands dirty. And this week, we're talking about Murph's favorite bulbs.
I got another one for you.
Okay.
There was at one time a Dutch princess that was so popular, Princess Irene had a tulip bulb named after her.
Oh.
And this one has an orange and purple combination that I find to be similar to the colors of sunset.
Okay.
And it's also a short tulip. So far, we've talked about one tall and two shorts. And now we move on to the Sidao. It's another short, and it's a ground cover type tulip bulb, deep red in color. But tulip bulbs are not the only bulbs that are great for fall planting and spring sprucing.
Well, what other suggestions might you have?
There's anemone. It's kind of a little aster flower kind of looking bulb. There's a Blanda type of anemone mix that has lots of whites and pale violets mixed together. Dutch iris and crocus, you can't really have tulip plants without these included in there to kind of round off the palette. Daffodils and hyacinth are also popular because they have shown some deterrence to rabbits and deer.
Yeah, I actually have some daffodil bulbs that I planted. I swear it must have been like 10 years ago, and these guys are still coming up. And I don't do anything with these guys. I just ignore them, and they just keep coming back.
Yeah, and to keep us out of trouble with Grow Corporate, I want to say that I've had lots of experience planting deer-resistant landscapes only to see the deer show up and chow down.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not guarantee you that that's going to happen with crocus and daffodils, but they seem to be less attractive than some of the other flavors that they like. There is hyacinth, grape hyacinth, because I love the purples and the blues. I think they're just fantastic, and they have this neat, like, little Queen's Guard helmet-type flower. I just think it's really neat, you know, compared to the little cup-shaped tulips. And then there's Siberian squill.
Squill?
And we've all seen this, but a lot of us don't know what it's called.
What's it look like?
And it looks a little bit like the hyacinth, and it's got kind of like a tall, skinny central cluster, and the flowers kind of hang down. And it's kind of a hairy-looking flower, similar to, say, a witch hazel flower. But again, I like this one because it comes in violets. And if you're really wanting to kind of get on the bandwagon with tulips and you want to give it the first try, I can recommend a couple of tulips that are very fashionable right now.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, and the black or chocolate tulips are super popular.
Black Coco Chanel would love that.
She would. And they also come in the 2 to 3, depending upon how you look at it, the various heights that they come in. And then there is blue tulip. There is such thing as a blue tulip.
It's really blue.
There's a couple that I found that I think are fabulous, and we're going to have to talk about it again next year because I'm going to plant these for the first time.
So we're going to find out how well they work. What are they called?
Sky Blue.
All right.
Sky Blue. The name describes everything you need to know about this tall tulip. And then a version that's similar in color but shorter in stature is the Triumph. Again, another kind of true blue, not a purple. More like a faded pair of blue jeans, indigo color.
That's amazing.
And you got to love that. So these are Tulips are best planted in mass, just like our spring, summer, and fall annuals.
Mm-hmm.
I call that the Disney effect, you know, when
yes.
you see one loud presentation of color displayed in mass.
Mm-hmm.
Do that with your tulip bulbs.
Yeah, and don't forget to mulch over them. Give them a watering after you put them in and mulch over them, right?
That's right, for sure, mulching over them. And if you take us up on the recommendation to use the soil probe, it's going to make the planting go so much faster.
Okay, that's great advice. Thank you so much, Murph, and I'm looking forward to having a fashionable planting bed.
As always.
Absolutely. Now, next week on GLT's Grow, thatch and how to deal with it. Now, do you have a gardening question or problem that you would like Murph to answer? Go to our website, wglt.org/grow, fill in the form, and then just send it along to us. And Murph will take a look at your question to answer on the air. That's wglt.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes or wglt.org. The hit true crime podcast Suspect Convictions is revisiting a 1998 Bloomington murder, and you'll hear every episode on GLT. On this week's episode, a closer look at the physical evidence against convicted murderer Barton McNeil. Prosecutors say there were signs of sexual abuse on his daughter's body, undercutting his alternate theory of the crime. Listen Fridays during Sound Ideas at noon and 6 for Suspect Convictions. Learn more at wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. If you've seen a flock of wild turkeys wandering through your front yard recently, no, you are not going crazy. Just in time for Thanksgiving, GLT's Ryan Denham sat down with ISU professor and bird expert Angelo Caparella for an explanation.
Well, wild turkeys have been recovering throughout Illinois. They're well established now after initially being wiped out around the early 1900s. And then the IDNR spent a lot of effort reintroducing them and spreading them around Illinois, so they're now found throughout the state again. And so there's even a hunting season on them now because they've rebounded so well. For quite some time, we've been getting reports of large, particularly winter flocks, out in the countryside along the Mackinac River corridor and places like that. And then in more recent years, we've been getting reports of individuals that have been showing up kind of wandering through town. And then this past summer, it was discovered that one was nesting on the north side of Constitution Trail in North Normal. And so that's the one that's garnered a lot of attention because the hen and its young, the poults, have been sort of wandering around, and people get to see them if they take Constitution Trail on the north side of Normal. And so I think that's what has garnered a lot of the interest about them actually now showing up within town and not just out in the countryside.
So we should see this as a good thing, the fact that the wild turkey population has recovered to the point where we're seeing them like literally walking down our streets.
Yeah, definitely. Although it is a little curious because typically you think of wild turkeys as in denser woods, more extensive woodlands and the like, but they seem to be adapting to our more fragmented landscape and therefore are starting to show up in places that you wouldn't normally have predicted that they would just because in suburbia or in the town, you just don't expect any kind of continuous woodlands. But apparently there was enough of a strip and good nesting area, grassy nesting area along North Constitution Trail that a family set up shop there, and that's what people have been seeing. A single female will have quite a few young, 10 to 12 young or so, and so it's a nice flock that is a family group.
Can you talk at all about, are wild turkeys generally friendly? If you see a couple of wild turkeys walking across your front lawn, is that something to worry about, or are they prone to nip at you, anything like that?
Typically not. The tom turkey, the male, during breeding season in the spring, might become somewhat aggressive, so you know you don't want to encourage them to visit your feeder or whatnot if you're concerned about that. And occasionally, just like a lot of birds, they get infatuated with their reflection in shiny surfaces. So if one starts attacking your car, that's probably what's going on. But again, that usually is in the spring when the tom turkeys are more aggressive with the hormones circulating and all of that. But in general, it's not something to be afraid of. Again, with most wildlife, just if you are concerned about them being in your yard, just don't include things that they want to eat in your yard.
not that we want to encourage people to go out with their rifles in their front lawn and start shooting wild turkeys, but you did talk about that the population has recovered to the point where there is actually a hunting season now for wild turkey that's been restored. Is that how you put it?
Yes, there's a regulated hunting season. You're not allowed to hunt without a permit, and obviously only in places where hunting is allowed. If you do have a problem with a nuisance turkey for some reason, you can always call the IDNR and they can take care of it, trap it or whatever. But in typical, it's very rare that I've heard of any real issues with wild turkeys. To me, they're just great to see, particularly when they form these big winter flocks. I've heard of as many as a flock of 50 up around Lake Bloomington Road being seen up along the Mackinac River corridor, where kind of you'd more expect them since it's nice and wooded and good riparian woodlands. Again, how big the populations will get actually within town, that'll be interesting to see, because I don't usually think of them as an inside town bird. Clearly, this one female took up shop and has been successful. So who knows? The poults might be seeing town as a good place to live as well. A lot will depend, obviously, on the food source and the extent of disturbance that they face. But it is a pretty neat phenomenon. And again, considering that we started at one time from zero in the early 1900s, and now we've got a really healthy population of wild turkeys, it's been a real conservation success story.
That's ISU professor and bird expert Angelo Caparello speaking with GLT's Ryan Denham about flocks of wild turkeys spotted around Bloomington Normal. We're tracking where and when the turkeys have been spotted because it's fun and because we can. You can gobble up our interactive turkey tracker map at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and individual stories and interviews from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Judy Valente. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal.